Welcome to Journeys of Romance. I'm your host, Jess Michaels. Today's guest is a best-selling historical romance author with a very interesting backstory of her own that I can't wait to sort of explore a little further. So please welcome Kate Bateman.
Hello. Hi. Nice to be here.
I know. I'm excited to have you. I feel like, well, like you and I were on a panel together at some point, like recently, kind of on Zoom, I remember.
Yeah.
And I felt like that was like the first time I've actually met you, I feel like. Is that correct?
I've haunted the various conferences and things, you know, the big in person, but they're so enormous with like 3,000 people that you very rarely bump into people you want to bump into. So yeah, I think that.
Well, and then also like if someone doesn't become your conference buddy, like the person that you bump into all the time, then like you're lost. Like I bump into the same 8 people at every conference, and then there's like 1,000 other people or 3,000 other people that I never bump into. And I don't understand the mathematics of that.
So true. And usually it's alphabetical. So I Suzanne Brockman and myself are always next to each other for some reason, because it's all the signings go alphabetically. So unless you're in the bar, that's usually where I am. It's a gin and tonic in the bar.
Sometimes I'm in the bar, to be fair. But then the bar is always packed. Like they're never prepared for us at the bar, I feel like. They never understand, unless we've been there before, like what is about to happen to them.
So embrace them about romance conferences, yeah.
I feel like that it's not something you can explain. Like you just have to experience it, you know? Like, I mean, I've tried, my mother actually went with me once to actually here in Dallas. I'm one of the conferences, and I tried to explain a lot. And then like at the end of the first night, she came back to the room and she was like, oh, I'm like, yeah, no, I tried to tell you.
They're amazing. Romance Landia is amazing. And I, you know, I'm fairly new to this, having just moved to the States, you know, a few years ago. And it's just, I love it. It's incredible. I mean, it's such an inclusive, friendly atmosphere to be with. But
It's, I mean, it feels like, for the most part, I mean, certainly there are exceptions and things that, you know, we all have to work better at. But I mean, it is a place where it feels like you could say, hey, I need help, or, you know, oh, I'm sitting by myself. And, you know, you can get caught up pretty quickly by some group of people that's like, oh, welcome. The welcoming committee type of people. There's a lot of those people.
Because, I think a few years ago, I went to the RT. I think it was one of the last RTs down in Atlanta. There was the romance half of it. And the other half of the conference was taken up by some medical convention. And about 2 days in, this whole bunch of people came up to us at the bar and said, you guys are having so much better conference than we are. Like, what, who are you guys? And we're like, we're romance writers. And they're like, can we come to your parties? We're like, yeah, you can. So we had...
All right. Everyone's like, yes, of course.
There were people like selling stethoscopes and stuff. But they had a great time with karaoke. So, you know,
yeah, well, of course. when they used to do the conference down here in Dallas, or the couple times that they did, it was always at the same time as the Mary Kay conference. And that was a weird combo, because like the Mary Kay people had a certain level of, like, you had to dress a certain way, you had to, you know. And I remember being in an elevator and this lady was like, I don't think she said it to me, but she said it to somebody else. She's like, you're not wearing pantyhose, so you know that that's not okay. And all of us are like, what? Was that a rule? And then we realized she was Mary Kay. She wasn't with us. And they like they were mad. They were not happy. But it was like, well, what do you want? Like, sorry. Like, it felt like a bad reaction to us, because like, dude, you're selling makeup. Like, you should be like, oh my God, this is an opportunity.
You should be like, oh, you could lengthen your lashes with our new mascara or something.
Right. You know, or be like, oh, you guys are all going to go to a super fancy party. On They still had the Rita's on Saturday at that time. Like, on Saturday, like, what could Mary Kay do about that? Like, I don't know. I just felt like at least this one woman was like so caught up in the concept that some of us weren't wearing pantyhose that she just like really lost the thread on that she was missing out on an audience for her makeup.
Oh well, hey ho.
Her loss. So were you always a big reader?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I read, you know, as a kid, I used to love reading, and I ended up doing French, English and history at kind of A level, and then going on to do English literature and French at university. And so I always thought, you know, path to publication, I always thought I was going to be a journalist or something in that kind of writing-y vein. But then almost as soon, all through this university and school time, my parents had an antique shop, and then I came out of uni and I did a few journalism-y kind of things. I worked for Cosmo and Cosmopolitan magazine for a bit, and I worked for Nature, the Macmillan Science Journal, for a bit. But then about a year or two after I graduated, my dad said, oh, I'm fed up of running an auction, a shop, an antique shop. It's all in auctions and it's all going to be online. He was quite visionary and he's like, it's all going to be like eBay. You know, people are going to start going to traditional auctions online and I'm just going to open an auction house and I need you to come back and help me run it. And I was living down in London at the time. And he said, you know, he was a fine artist as well. So he knows paintings and furniture from the shop. And he's like, I'm going to do those and you can just do everything else. You know, that just do all the other stuff. And I was so stupid. I was like, yeah, this sounds fun. We'll do it for a few years. And then I realized that all the other stuff was actually 90% of stuff that comes into the auction, which is like pottery, porcelain, you know, jewelry, everything, you know, everything you can think of, medals, postcards, you know. So I did a few, like a year of crash courses learning about all this stuff, you know, gemology and stuff. And then we opened our auction house. So I did that then for 10 years and I kind of got derailed. Life happened. And I know I was kind of writing some fun stuff for myself in the background, but I really didn't have time running the auction house to do proper writing.
Yeah, I mean, it seemed like it was a really intensely like full-time job.
Yeah, and I loved it. It was amazing. I really never thought I would, you know, finish. And about 10 years in, my husband got the chance to come out here. We're obviously both English and he works for an American company and he had the chance to come here for a, you know, a very short 2 or 3 year placement. So I thought, okay, it'd be an adventure, you know, family was still helping to run the sale room. So I literally walked out one day. I said, oh, you know, I'll be back in 2 years. You know, that's a sale a month, 24 sales. You'll barely miss me. I'll be back before you know it. Packed up and went. And of course, then it sort of, that was 11 years ago. And so I'm still here. And after about 3 or 4 years, it was like, we kind of thought about getting the green card and converting. And like, they kept Skyping me and saying, are you guys coming home anytime soon? And I was like, not really. No, not.
Turns out, no.
Yeah. So not, yeah, it was. And then having had another kid out here, so I've now got 3 kids, I came out of the baby haze and thought, I've got to do something. I will go bananas because I can't run an auction house here because I'm in the Midwest and there's not enough antique stuff that I know about to run a sale room here. And the laws are different. I'd have to retrain to do some stuff. So I thought, okay, well, I still like writing. So I went and knuckled down and thought, okay, I'm just going to write what I like to read, which is historical romance, and try it. You know, what's the worst that'll happen is it won't be the worst book ever written, probably. So that's what I did. And I sent it off. And I was lucky enough to enter some RWA contests and won them. And that got me in front of an editor. And that's how I got my first 3-book deal was with Random House. It was really cool.
So, I mean, it seems like that opportunity to come to the United States and then it kind of cut you off from what you were doing, like kind of opened up that door to just be like, try some stuff. And this was the stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it forced me to do something that I hadn't really considered. Back in the England, it was ironically just before Harry Potter and I'd had some kind of read some kids' book and thought, oh, there's a real gap in that middle grade market for something cool and magical, like, you know, The Secret Seven, and, you know, don't remember, we used to watch The Worst Witch and stuff. I don't know if you get that here, but I thought, okay, so I wrote, it was the elevator pitch for the book that I wrote Quantum Leap. Do you remember Quantum Leap? It was Quantum
Yes.
Leap for kids, so it had these 2 kids that jumped through history to try.
Oh, yeah, that's a cool idea.
Super cool. And I wrote it, and actually, ironically, just before I left for the States, that got picked up by an English publisher. And then I went to States, and I kind of let it drop. I didn't take them up on their offer, but I kind of had that on the back burner. So that was my first actual manuscript, was a middle grade kids thing. And then, of course, Harry Potter came out, and they're like, yeah, no. but no, I switched to a romance because I loved it so much. And that's where my heart lies, is the historical romance. And obviously, I had all that history background going to waste. So I had to do something with that, too. So.
So in your bio, it talks about that you were a UK television art expert. Was it sort of like a... I can't think of the
Antiques Roadshow.
Yeah, Antiques Roadshow. It was kind of like that kind of a show.
Yeah, I did. That was a kind of a spin-off from the auction house. So there's 3 different shows I ended up doing. I was the on-screen expert. There's one called Bargain Hunt and one called Flog It. And the other one's called Put Your Money Where Your Mouth Is, which are kind of like the Antiques Roadshow, only it's like the Antiques Roadshow, but then they usually sell it at the end because they come and get the valuation from like the experts like me. And then they either take it to auction or they'll have bought it and they're trying to make a profit. That's like the game show format, which is Bargain Hunt. So I did that for the whole 10 years that I was there, on and off. And I'm still endlessly on repeats on that. A couple of the shows have finished now, but they show them endlessly. So people in the UK still think I'm there in the UK doing that.
Appraising for auction.
Yeah, I still do some freelance stuff. So people still send me some, I do emails, and I can do a lot by photos. So actually, I still
do
that. But yeah,
that's crazy. I mean, like, it's like, what a fun, strange journey that is, to just be like, oh, and also
it was really fun, and they're great fun to film. I mean, you spend like, is it, you film about 3 shows back to back over a long weekend or over a week, and you used to get to go to stuff, and then occasionally you'd have cutout bits where you just do a little piece to camera on something interesting. So I got to do some really crazy stuff, like go on a shovel coal on a steam train, and you know, really bonkers things that you'd never get to do normally, just because it makes for fun telly. I got to go to France. I did a work program in France for the flea markets there once. So yeah, I miss that. I'd do that in a heartbeat if I was back in the UK. Yeah.
Do you feel like that having that experience, both of, you know, working with antiques and also, you know, sort of doing the show where you sort of would go and do these interesting, you know, interstitial, you know, filming or whatever, to connect to whatever you were doing. Do you feel like that influenced anything when you were writing? I mean, just because you are sort of looking and touching things from perhaps the era that you're writing in, or, I mean, did you ever spark ideas from something that you had looked at or seen?
Absolutely. And yeah, and it kind of gets you thinking about, in you know, the backstory of everything. In the antiques world, we call it like provenance. It's like the story, and it adds value. So it's kind of an interesting concept that somebody can bring something in, and you tell the sum of its parts is, you know, say it's a ring. We had one a few years ago. It was, you know, it's a diamond ring and sapphires, and it's band of gold. So, you know, this much diamond, this much gold comes to about £2,000, say, whatever. And then, so that's the kind of value of it in one sense. And then if you said, oh well, this was the ring that Napoleon gave to Josephine, instead of £2,000, it's like £2 million or £200 million.
Right.
So, and all that's changed is the story. So the romance of that has added some 10 times value to it. So it's kind of, I love that concept of story adding value to things. I find that really interesting. And like, we're storytelling creatures. We want that from pictures on cave walls. That adds value to our lives and helps us understand things. So I loved, you know, every day people were bringing stuff in. It was like Christmas every day at the Sarum. You know, they bring something and tell you the story of it. And sometimes you could put that story in the catalogue description, and sometimes it didn't mean anything to the person buying it. It was just something really personal to the, you know, the person selling it. So things like medals, they broke my heart that people would sell military medals. And
stuff. Yeah.
I was like, this was your great granddad. You know, why are you selling this? So yeah, and the job of a writer is like the what if, you know, to question like, oh, where, you know, this fan, who held this fan in a ball in the Regency England? You know, what were they doing with this, you know, this thing? What if these things could talk? What would they tell me? What scandals have they heard? You know,
mm-hmm.
So I kind of really like that idea. And of course, it sort of helps and hinders, because when I'm comfortable in the Regency era, because I've seen so many things that are from that time. So I know what they all look like. So I don't know whether I over describe things because clearly I'm excited by them and I love them and I want to talk about them, or under describe them because I know what they look like, so I assume everyone else knows what I'm talking about when I say a reticule or a, you know, chaise longue or something. So I'm not sure. I've had various feedback. I can get a bit over the top with describing the decorations and stuff. I've occasionally had editors come back and say, you know, maybe we should tone down the half page talking about the, you know, furnishings and stuff, you know.
But they're important.
If I'm going to be, you know, seduced on a chaise, I want to know what the fabric's like, but apparently not, no.
But I mean, there is a readership, because that's the thing, right? So you have this wide variety in historical romance of, from here's every detail of the battle of whatever in this war, and it's going to come down to the smell, the sight, the taste, the sound, like every single minute detail. And then you have sort of a more wallpapery kind of historical, where, which is more what I write. I mean, not that I don't care about details. I have them, I use them, but I, you know, I am driven more by the characters and the story and that sort of thing. Like I don't, probably it's just the way that my brain works. Like I don't focus on those details. And there's a wide variety of people that write all of the layers between those two things, and a wide variety of readers. Like there's some readers that they want every single detail, and they don't want something that is lighter on those details. And there are people that, like, they just don't care. Like they just want to be seduced by the story or seduced by the characters. And so as long as it is reasonably accurate, right, they're not going to freak out. And so, I mean, I think there's always a place for, I mean, there's somebody that wants to know every detail of the chaise. You know what I mean? Like, they want to know. They want to picture themselves on it. They want to feel it underneath their hands. Like, that's really important to them. So, I mean, I do think that there's something to be said for that.
Yeah,
Some people
that's the
that helps
art.
them get lost in it.
That's the art of the author is knowing how much to leave in and how much to put out. And I mean, yeah, I think you only need a sprinkling of to get the feel of it, because I think most people, especially with Regency, it's not like we're writing a time where it is really different and people aren't used to it. I think Georgian England or something, very different. You'd have to describe it more, but I think people have a general idea going into a Regency of what to expect without us. It kind of there's all that baggage that we don't have to describe the first time of the carriage and the ballroom because people already have that in their brains. So they'd rather you only need a few specific details to make it, to sprinkle it in there to give you the flavor of it. And I don't know, this historical accuracy debate, which has come up again with Bridgerton recently, is like we're writing historical fantasy. It's fiction. I mean, I find it really funny when people get nitpicky over, some details, like, okay, don't put electricity in Georgian England, that's just stupid. But at the same time, why are we always fine to say that, all the dukes were hot and 28, and yet they're in reality they're all drunk, gouty, inbred disasters? I mean, we're fine to
Toothless.
suspend that disbelief, but we're not okay to suspend, maybe a horse going 2 miles an hour faster than it should have done to get them to the elopement the day before. I mean, people get ridiculous, and we're not pretending to be historical. Well, at least I'm not. I don't think many of us are trying to be historical fiction. We're not trying to say this is how, this is actually accurate. It is an entertainment. We are fiction, and I that's why I enjoy writing it. I don't want the reality of the syphilis and people bathing once a week. I want the romantic bit of it. I'm picking and choosing the fun bits.
Yeah, I want breath to be fresh and I don't want to talk about chamber pots.
Exactly, and Bordeloos and so. I don't know, it's a very odd thing. I mean, you could debate all the time about what's historically accurate and not. And I think you're right, there is such a range of people out there. Every reader can find authors that satisfy whatever, degree of accuracy they want and stick to them. And I mean, I kind of, so long as it's nothing really terrible, it doesn't
Right, like electricity or, like a motorcycle or
Yeah,
something.
exactly.
And then the motorcycle flew by. But I mean the other part of that is that some of this historical accuracy debate is really just a smoke screen for, I am racist and I don't want to see inclusivity and I want to pretend like that no one existed in these times that wasn't white, no one existed in these times that wasn't straight, no one existed in these times that had sex and enjoyed it. So like they want to eliminate the reality, which is that people of color existed in the Regency. People of color thrived in the Regency in a lot of cases. People who were not straight lived in the Regency and or any time. I mean, Regency is just that's what we write. So that's I think the place that we
Different
go.
world, right? Everybody's existed. They just had to do things slightly differently depending on the, restrictions placed on them from the time they were in. So, I mean, yeah, of course they existed. It would be ridiculous to suggest they didn't, but
But I mean, I think it's just like and sometimes it's that smoke screen of like, oh, well, it's historical accuracy, but it's like, again, you pick and choose that historical accuracy because you don't mind the 28-year-old ab-ridden Duke. Like, you know how guys get abs? They go to the gym. Nobody gets abs from just like hanging out and like working. Like, you can get arms or legs by just like working, but you don't get abs that way. So like, if you have abs and you're a Duke, you're not historically accurate. Like, Dukes were not doing crunches and like working out on the row machine. Like, that didn't exist.
Chicken skin gloves and telling other people to do the hard work,
Yes, like probably, yeah. It's so yeah. I mean, it's like the ability to pick and choose what you want to be historically accurate and how does that impact both reality of real historical accuracy, but also like, being allowing for it not all to be so homogenous. Which I don't think serves our particular genre particularly well.
If
Well,
we
it's
want a
so
future with
boring.
readers.
As a
So.
reader, you want that depth and breadth of story options,
Yes.
right? You want every. I mean, I'm still incredibly frustrated that we are stuck on the, 8 or 9 years of the Regency when there is the rest of history out there. Why on earth has traditional publishing decided? And my first book was not a Regency. I had read Laura Kinsale's. She did some medievals, which was For My Lady's Heart and Shadow Heart, which I adore. And they're kind of hard going because she uses like ye olde English. But I read it and thought, this was amazing. I want to read some more of this. And I really couldn't find anything. And then I kind of stumbled on, you know, other you know, time periods. So then I was like, clearly Regency is the big one. And I've read great ones and I've read terrible ones of those. But there is a lot of other things. I mean, apart from like Scottish medievals and, you know, Regencies. And there's a few people doing Georgian and there's a few people doing Gilded Age now. But I mean, there's the rest of history to kind of expand into. And I really hope that's going to be the case in years to come, that people are going to go for it. I mean, yeah, so the first book I wrote was Medieval Italy, because I thought, okay, think of the potential for like killing people off in horrible ways. And, you know, the Borgias were horrible. I mean, the history is worse and more scandalous than, you know, I could ever make up. I mean, it's...
Right. People wouldn't believe it.
It's not historically accurate. You're like, it absolutely was. I mean, all my plots are based on actual historical events. And I wrote that book and it was great. It's called Devil to Pay. And it was a Rita finalist 1 year. And what's so funny is it didn't fit the mold. And of course, my publishers came and said, we can't sell this. You know, we love this book. This was before I had the contract. And they said, we love what you write and we love your style, but could you write a Regency? And I was like, sure. But
yeah.
That's a great book. I self-published it after I'd been trad-published a few years, and it's done really well. I mean, it's not in a series, it's a standalone. But the point is that there's no market for something until you make one and create it. I mean, there wasn't one for Outlander until time travel romance was written, or for 50 Shades, you know what I mean? So
yeah,
I think write it and they will come. So I hope all the authors out there that are thinking about writing some really weird out there obscure romance, do it. You know, I'll read it if nobody else. Do it. Someone out there will find it and love it.
Well, and it does beg an interesting question, or I suppose topic, and that, you know, I mean, the traditional publishing market was the only real like market where you could get a foothold for such a long time. The traditional publishing market was like kind of where you had to be for a really long time if you wanted distribution. Like, there wasn't that there weren't other things, but like that was if you wanted like the massive level of distribution and to be able to hit a list and all that stuff, like that was kind of where you had to go. And so they were the ones dictating what got written, because they were the ones that were dictating what got published, right? So, I mean, they spent a long time saying, we can't sell X, we can't market X, nobody wants to read X, and you can fill in the blank for whatever X is.
Yeah.
And then as indie publishing took off, people were writing all of those X's and doing extremely well. And the reason for that is, of course, multiple things. One is, they didn't create a market for those things, so then they could say there was no market, because
you have to offer it, so otherwise you don't know if people are
yeah. I mean, if you literally only ever publish Regency era historical romance,
yeah,
that is literally what anyone, that is the only thing anyone will buy, because it's the only thing available. So I mean, to sit there and say there's no market for whatever, it's ridiculous if you're never allowing whatever to exist, right? And then there's also that as an indie author, you have so much more space to, like, I can sell far fewer copies and make the same or more money.
Yeah.
So I write Regency, so I'm never backing into a niche, but if I decide to write something that is, you know, less traditionally marketable, whatever they call that, right? And there's 5,000 people that want to buy it, and I can tap into 5,000 people buying it, I've made a pretty good amount of money, versus maybe for a traditional publisher, it's just not enough to take, you know, to go over the top for what their costs are.
Exactly. And it's, I mean, for them, it is a big risk. And of course, you know, I played the game and said, hey, you know, I did write my first three books for Random House were, they call it digital first, which means published in print never, basically. So I did those three books and I wrote them and they did really well. But then I swapped over to St. Martin's because I got a print deal with St. Martin's for my next three. But they were still, you know, I kept pitching things like, so my first three books for Random House were like, sure, they're Regency, but like the first one's 90% in Napoleonic France. The second one's 90% Spain, because it's like a road trip, peninsula road trip. And then the third one is basically in England. So I kind of tell them it's Regency. And then as soon as I hand it in, my agent will come back and goes, there's actually only three chapters in a ballroom in London. I'm like, yeah, well, you know. It's still Regency technically. I got away with it. And so my next series that I'm currently, I've finished up book one, that it's going to be published later this year for my new series, is I've managed to get away from London ballrooms. I don't know how I managed it. I've broken loose. And it's going to be on the borders between England and Wales. So it's still Regency. And there is still some scenes in London. But mainly it's the borderland, England-Wales border in the Regency. So it's kind of in the countryside, country house type thing. So I'm hoping that's going to be... I'm really excited to write them. It's two families that hate each other forever. Like the Hatfields and McCoys, but in the Regency, basically. So I think there is scope to kind of mix it up a little. Because, I mean... the standard ballroom, you know, debutante kind of thing has been done, I think, almost endlessly. So unless you've got a really fresh spin on that, I don't want to be writing something that bores me. I'd rather do something a bit weird and out there that I want to read.
Well, and the nice thing is there are so many more options. I mean, if you bumped up against an idea that you really wanted to write and they said, no, we can't market that, then you could market it yourself. I mean, and now you have enough of a name that people want to buy a Kate Bateman book. They don't necessarily... as long as you give them what they expect as far as, you know, the romance going well and whatever level of heat that you're usually writing and, you know, I mean, whatever kind of sense that it has. Like, I have fairly dark sort of sexy books versus like someone that's writing something lighter, frothier, like that expectation that you've created as a Kate Bateman book. As long as you meet that, like, I think that the readership begins to open up a little bit more to be like, well, I just really want a Kate Bateman book that feels like this. And then you can make that book in any place and they still connect to it the same way.
I hope so. I mean, yeah, my freebie for my newsletter is a novella I did for it was an anthology, but it's now free in the world, and it was a kind of homage to Indiana Jones and Marion Ravenwood, that kind of, and the mummy, you know, that whatever it is, Rachel Weisz mummy. It was an Egypt set Regency, and it was so much fun to write because I had no pressure. It was never going to be traditionally published, so I had so much fun with it. And the only thing I regret is that because it's a novella, I couldn't get my full-on sexy scenes in there because it's just too short. In 40,000 words, I can't get them into the sack in that point. But I might do like an add-on. I might expand it and turn it into a full length, because I personally feel cheated if I don't get a full sex scene out of it.
Me too.
Because for me, that kind of rounds up a full relationship, right? But I mean, I don't write on the sweet end like you. You know, we both like to write, you know, I want the details. I don't want erotica, but I do want to... the reactions of all the characters, and I want to see them get a completed, you know, physical relationship as well as a kind of mental relationship going on.
Well, I mean, I feel like a love scene tells, like, if you can skip a love scene that's been written, obviously, that's what I mean. Not that if you don't write a love scene, but like if you have written a love scene and it's something that someone can skip because it doesn't advance the character, the story, or the emotional, you know, journey, then you've probably missed something in the writing of it. Like, if it doesn't tie into the story and become an integral part of the story, then I don't understand what you're doing.
Yeah.
And maybe that's just me. Like, but I want that. And I feel like it is a part of, for me as a writer, like showing that relationship go further.
Yeah, because I mean, the reactions in a sex scene, the way that your two characters react, it should be only they would react that way. They're the only two people who would say those things or do those things in that moment. And if you could interchange them with someone else, then they're not good enough characters. You know, they're not interesting enough, or they don't have enough individual flaws and stuff to make it work. So, yeah.
I think sometimes people don't realize a love scene is still a scene. Like, it still has to have a purpose beyond just like taking the clothes off and putting tabs in slots or, you know, whatever you end up doing. It's got to be more than just like, about people, you put a hand here and then a hand went there and then this happened, you know, a tongue and whatever. Like, it has to advance some part of the plot in some way. Character, you know, plot or emotion has to be advanced through it. And again, like, I mean, I feel like if you could skip a scene, then I've probably done something wrong. Cause it should be something where if you would go, wait, what did I miss? You know, and when you get to the next scene and now you're onto this next emotional, you enter into the scene in one emotion, you leave the scene in another emotion. Now you're going into the next scene in that emotion or in some variation. I want someone who has skipped that scene to go like, wait, I missed something.
Exactly. And it should make, you know, usually my sex scenes are about the 50% mark, which is where everything is suddenly, even if it's going well at that moment, everything's about to go horribly wrong for them for the rest of the book until right at the end. So, I mean, I love the fact that it's right on that pivotal moment of things are going really great, but after the sex scene or even during the sex scene, something's going to happen that you're like, wait, what?
Uh-oh. Like,
even if it's like, yay, we've done it, it's like now there's a whole new barrel of, you know, second worms can kind of open up.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I also go back to the historical accuracy thing. I mean, I get a lot of I mean, you probably get the same, is that people say, oh, you know, you're writing, you're too modern a heroine. It's mainly the heroines. Your heroines are too modern. They're modern women, but you're putting them in a historical setting. And because I guess they mean I'm giving them agency or, mm-hmm. or whatever. But
yeah, they don't like that. They don't like agency, those historical crazy. Accuracy
and,
people.
And then I will point them to the, like, the real historical woman that I'm basing it on. You're like, Lucretia, or whoever it is that I've dealt with, and, you know, this real female forger that I found, or, you know, whoever, the code breaker, this the thief. And then when they're kind of given that, you're just like, well, of course they existed. You're just, you know, either the records didn't exist or it's taking me a lot of research to find out about them. But of course they were there. You know, they're 50% of the population for a start. And they might not have had agency in the way that you think of it today, but women have always been able to work around the parameters of whatever, you know, social strictures there are. And that's why I like Regency, because I like giving them these constraints of what you should and shouldn't do. And I love pushing those boundaries of, well, can we get away with it? And can I do this but not this? And see how those clever women get around those problems. And, you know, that to me makes for an interesting story. I think I can't write contemporary because, you know, pretty much everyone can do anything nowadays, short of murdering somebody. I mean,
you can do what you like. And you could probably find a way to make that work.
Not much to rebel against. I quite like the fact that back in historical times there were all these disapproving people, and there were these kind of big stakes of, you know, you will, you know, lose your reputation or you will get disowned or whatever, and then trying to find your way out around those obstacles is kind of interesting as mm-hmm. I'm plotting, at least, to find out, you know, can I make this work for this character? Can I still give them the happy ending with that agency?
Yeah. And well, and again, it's like just the concept that no one had agency, like you said, it's ridiculous. And also that, like, or like consent, sometimes I hear it around consent, like, well, you know, a guy at that time wouldn't ask. I'm like, well, a decent guy probably always was asking.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, I'm not writing a dude. I don't want to write about a dude that doesn't ask, that doesn't want enthusiastic participation. Like, I don't want that. I don't want to write about that guy. I'm not interested in him. But, you know, it's funny because so I'll be at 100 books next year, so I'm in the 90 something. And, like, I actually don't really get it as much anymore. I think people have just, like, I just beat it out of them. There's, like, you know, the first, like, 10 or 20 books, they were like, no, historical accuracy. And then I was like, I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing. And those people just kind of stopped reading me, or they gave up on contacting me because they weren't getting one they wanted. I don't know if they're still reading. But they're the ones, like, that occasionally, you know, they give a rating without a review or whatever. Yeah. So, I mean, I feel like at some point I just kind of, like, we went head to head and I won. Like, we played chicken and I won. So.
Quite often they're wrong. I mean, that's what having a...
Yes, that's what's frustrating. They're wrong.
You know, I get that a lot. You know, the medieval, I got lots of people saying, oh, you know, you mentioned a magnet or a compass. And I'm like, well, you know, this is in the 1300s. I said Marco Polo used a compass to get to China in the 1100s. Why do you think? Okay, they might have called it a lodestone or something, but the fact that I'm, and that's the other thing, do you use modern language? We're writing for a modern audience. So I could write the entire Regency thing in what I think is Regency language kind of thing, or even the medieval. But it's like, where do you stop? Should I have written the medieval Italian in medieval Italian? I mean, I'm writing
right.
for a modern American English audience. So it has to be accessible. So I think that's the thing. We have to care about these characters. No one wants to write or read about a fully subservient, you know, henpecked, crushed woman who had no agency. That's not an adventure. I want the woman that, you know, divorced her husband and sailed off and had a pirate ship. You know, that's
right.
That's what I want.
I know. That sounds more fun. I can get lost in that. Like, I don't feel like I could. I mean, you know. Again, like, you're writing, here is a person who is coming against, like, these constraints. And then how are they going to subvert these constraints and do something amazing, you know, or find an amazing love, you know, a love worth subverting constraints for, you know.
Triumphant, otherwise it's not happy ever after, right? So, and there are these real people in history that have done this forever, and I don't know why people are so surprised, you know, but you find them all the time researching them and you're like, well, yeah, of course.
Yeah. So what is your actual process when you're writing a Kate Bateman book? Like, do you plot, do you pants? How do you sort of build that out?
I understand the sensibleness of actually plotting, but my brain doesn't seem to like it. So I've got better at it. I've got this wall of crazy that is just like post-it notes that I kind of move around. And for every book, I've probably got like two or three really strong scenes that I have in my head that's just like a funny incident or something that I want to happen. And the
Is that what you start with, like a scene that'll pop into your head usually, or?
yeah, I like the first one of the Counterfeit Heart, one of my other books, was I just had this image of this woman burning a bonfire of money. And I just thought that was a really great opening image of all this money going up in smoke. And she's a counterfeiter, so she's burning all her counterfeits. And that's where that kind of spark came from. I had another book that was like based on a real historical prison break that I had heard and thought, that is so cool, I have to put that in a book. So that's, yeah, usually there's a couple of a snippet of historical information that I found, like this Earl of mine was based on, I found out there were Regency submarines. Who knew? A
Wow.
submarine plot to rescue Napoleon from St. Helena. I thought, that is so cool. And, you know, if I hadn't actually researched it, I never knew that, you know, that they existed so early. And then, of course, my sexy brain is like, ooh, they're tight, you know, that's a really small, confined space.
That is the biggest, there's only one bed that it ever has been.
Tiny little submarine, even if it's ground, you know, even if it's land, they're going to hide in it and they're going to be smushed together. So usually there's like history Kate gets together with like, you know, sexy romance Kate and thinks, ooh, what's the weirdest place I can get these two people to cram together? And that's usually, yeah, that's how it happens. And that's where my best scenes seem to be born, is like my the book I've just written.
Sexy meets history.
It's all quite good.
Could they make out during this event?
There's a lot of, you know, stop shooting at people and kiss kind of thing, which is,
Yeah.
again, it's definitely fiction. My love, but the book I've just finished, they're all in a, they get in a cave, which is completely impractical. You know, it's cold, it's damp. The last thing you want to do is take your clothes off and make out. But, you know, I'm allowed this. We're allowed a bit of historical leeway. I think people will, you know, will
They'll forgive
put
it.
me away with that for a bit. Yeah.
Or they'll write you a very nasty letter.
Well.
One or the other.
Yeah.
So then you have like this, you know, spark, the spark that comes out of maybe something that you've researched, and you squish it together with the sexy, and then
Then
it's
I
so it's like a board that you have.
yeah, I kind of have scenes on post-it notes, and I know roughly, you know, you need you know, I basically create a structure and things like that. So I kind of do these main things, but I kind of pretend I'm not writing a book. I fool myself every time into not writing a book. So I just start a Word document, which is just like a few snippets of information and like a couple of funny quotes or something that I've, you know, and then maybe one of these scenes I'll start to flesh out, and then I'll have to think, okay, what's the worst thing I can do to this character? Because what's their, you know, what's their wound and their background and stuff? What's the worst? And I'll write a little scene. And then it kind of all fits together. And by the time I've got like 35,000 words, I'm like nearly got half a book. And then I'm like, oh, I'm writing a book. Ha! And then I just sort of string some scenes together.
Like, well, I'm halfway there. I might as well finish.
I mean, I've got like the big dark moment and the, you know, the all is lost and a few funny scenes and, you know, probably the sex scene because that's fun. And then you have to link them together. So it's kind of a bit of a scattergun approach, but
Kind of a tapestry, it sounds like.
it is. And I've got better because I used to massively overwrite and then chop out 15,000 words at the end. But now I've got much better to only writing 85,000 words to start with and saving myself a lot of grief and crying and my editor making me rock in a corner because I've cut out my babies. But yeah, that's about what I do. I do kind of hero and heroine sheets before I start, of like, you know, who are they, what were they doing, what's their background. They usually have very specific skills, or you know, like my women have, they're kind of badasses and goddesses, they're girls with cool skills, so like thieves or counterfeiters or archaeologists or something that's really specific to them. So that kind of grows the story as well, because then you're into language and imagery and things like the theme that can only be associated with that character. So like my counterfeiter, she was a French counterfeiter, that gives you a whole level of, you know, the bigger questions of, is what's real and what's fake? You know, is her money real and fake? Is the relationship real or fake? You know, and then you get this whole layering.
Yeah, you kind of get the theme mixed with
Yeah,
the.
and that kind of then spawns scenes and in sort of instances that you think, okay.
Right, because now you have the betrayal, and he
Yeah.
realizes something is fake, whether
She
it's
has to
relationship, the
prove
money,
she's
whatever.
real or fake, and how do you
Yeah.
prove that something, you know, so that kind of, yeah, I guess their characters spawn off some of the ideas and the images. So my next, the book that I'm just about to write is the idea of Roots and Wings. So he's an architect, and she's this crazy wild, you know, wild girl. And the idea that you need both of those, he is like Mr. It needs to be a right angle, you know, everything. I want to leave something beautiful behind. And she's like, you need this wildness, right? You have to have this crazy, beautiful garden along with your beautiful house. Otherwise, it's it's austere and they need each other. So yeah, I like the idea that they also have to be kind of a perfect fit, but also opposites, or need bits of each other to be complete. I think that's the whole point of my couple.
Yeah, I mean, it's always interesting when you read about characters who are, you know, opposing and yet like not so completely opposite that you feel like, yeah, they would hate each other in 6 months. Like, they just want to have sex. That's, they're not really, they don't really like each other. But that, like, they have complementing personalities, not necessarily all the same or all different. I mean, that's always, I mean, I suppose that's like what life is, right? Like, most people don't really want to be with someone who's absolutely completely opposite to them, but they want something that's complementary. So you kind of fill in the spaces where, like, where I'm weak, maybe my husband has strengths. Where I'm strong, he maybe has some weaknesses. And so we can, you know, I can step in and say, oh, well, what if we did it this way? And that's a way that maybe he wouldn't have thought of, and vice versa.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and a lot of people, I mean, I'm the same. I'm very creative and, you know, visually based and word based. And my husband's the utter opposite. He is literally an engineer. He's very logical and clever. And it's a cause of much tension, but also, as you say, a cause of, we complement each other really well because we each have our strengths, and as a whole it works really well. But a lot of people, especially when they find out you're a romance writer, go, oh, you know, you, are you talking about your husband, you know, is that what you're thinking about when you have sex, you know, you get all these questions. And you're like, well, no, if I'm any good as a you know, a fiction writer, it is fiction, right? Nobody asks Stephen King if he's actually murdered 20.
Yeah, how many people have you murdered? You know, like, no one asks that.
No, I'm a really good, I can imagine really well. You know, I have this active really? Imagination that is separate from my, you know, my actual real life. Not that my husband is not heroic, but he's, you know, he's heroic in a different way. And he's only heroic for me, which is great, as opposed to everyone else.
Well, I mean, because I think that there's a line, right, where we do bring some level of our, I mean, you can't help but bring some level of yourself into what you create, you know? I mean, like, it's not that I'm completely absent from anything that I've written. And I've certainly, I had a therapist once who read a book of mine, and she was like, you put a little bit of your stuff into there, don't you? I'm like, just a little bit. So, I mean, it's not that I never put any stuff, but yeah, it's an insulting thing to think that like every single book is me. Like, it's not me. I'm not that exciting. Like, I live in Dallas. I've been inside the house for almost a whole year. I have a dog. Like, I walk the dog. That's like literally the only time I see people. I'm boring.
I stare at the, you know, the walls for long periods of time, wondering what I can think of next. But yeah, I mean, it's me. I guess the things like the humor and the need for, you know, that snarky, I love that kind of sexy,
like banter kind of thing.
Yeah, that's, I love the enemies to lovers trope. I love the best
friend. Oh, I love enemies to lovers.
All of those are my catnip. So I write what I want to read. And I guess I am, you know, my husband and I bounce off each other quite a bit. So I suppose, yeah, I could only write that, you know. And I think the tone is the same, you know, it doesn't matter what time period I'm writing in. I think you still get a Casey Bateman or Kate Bateman tone to the stuff I've written.
Yeah, there's like a certain voice. The voice is the voice in some ways.
And that, yeah, and I suppose they're me, but what I think I would do if I was in that situation, or what I would do if I was a, you know, Russian princess undercover, or whatever it is that I'm writing, you know, and all the things I wish I would have the balls to do and probably wouldn't. But,
or if I did them, I'd be like, oh, I don't enjoy this, but I feel like I would want to enjoy it.
Exactly. And yeah, in real life it's probably much less fun, but on the pages of
it seems very exciting.
Yeah,
that chaos feels exciting when you read it or you create it, but I wouldn't necessarily want it in my real life. I don't really particularly care for chaos that much.
And that's what I want to give people, is that experience of, you know, feeling like they've visited somewhere different and had an adventure and then returned safely and happy to their armchair. I mean, a lot of people physically can't travel. I mean, this year has been the exact example of no one can physically travel. And yet you can still have a few hours escape from whatever it is, your daily life. And I would hope that, you know, it sounds kind of pathetic, but I mean, my one thing is that people, you know, if I've added one bit of happiness to the world by somebody reading the book and I've brightened their day a little bit, then I've done my job, right? That's my job, is to, I do a bit of history by stealth. I hope they learnt something historical that they also didn't know. But it's entertainment. I mean, I want people to enjoy it. I want them to
put it
and think, oh, that was really fun. I enjoyed that, you know.
Well, and I think that this year we've really seen how much it really does matter. I mean, like, so many people have said that romance is the thing that's getting them through. Reading books is what's getting them through. You know, I mean, reading something that has an escape that, you know, they, I mean, some people are enjoying reading stories that have, contemporary authors are always struggling with that. Do I write a story that has, that has COVID, either it happened or it is happening. Do I not? We don't have that as historical authors. We don't have to address that. But I mean, like, having that few hours, I mean, I've heard from multiple people that said that reading, not necessarily reading me or not reading me, some of dependent, but like that reading something has been the thing that has kept them, you know, kind of sane in this last year where we've all been sort of trapped and unable to do our normal things. So, I mean, I do think it's super important. And I think
it's as important as the doctor who saves your life. I mean, that sounds ridiculous, but it isn't. I think the doctors can save your body. And then if your soul is not nourished as well, you know, if you have to have mm-hmm. the will to live as well as the physical ability, right? So, I mean, there's just as much for the person in the hospital bed. If I'm providing the book to the person sitting next to them, you know, waiting for them to come around and it's helping them get through their day, then yeah, I've done my job and it's a damn good one. And I think that's worthwhile.
Well, you offer a break.
Yeah.
For 2 hours.
Yeah.
You know, where like everything is terrible, but in this 2 hour period, it is not terrible. And I also know because it's romance that it's going to be okay. And then that reminds me that things in the world can still be okay. So then I can go out and fight a little bit longer because it might be okay. Because romance says it'll be okay.
Well, exactly. You're a safe pair of hands. But there's still the thing of will they, won't they, if you do it well enough.
Right. Right. If you do it well, they know it's going to work out. And they're also terrified it is not going to work out. Like, oh my God, it's the best. When someone's like, I didn't know how you're going to work it out. I'm like, yes. Like, I trusted you would, but I didn't know how you were going to do it. Like, that's the best compliment in the world.
But I mean, there's enough bad stuff in the world. If I want bad stuff, I can just go and watch the news, you know?
Yes.
And it's so easy to destroy things. I find this all the time. It's even with negative reviews, right? It takes you 5 minutes to destroy something and to say, oh, that was terrible. One star. And it's, you know, it's taken me months of my life to write it. And it's taken you a couple of hours of your life to read it. And I always try and think about that. It's very difficult to create. It takes a lot of effort. And it doesn't seem like a balance in this world that it's so easy to destroy things, but it's a lot of effort to create things. Like, you know, even a baby, right? It takes 9 months to grow one, but people can die in like an instant. So there's this imbalance. So we need this kind of the good stuff. You need romance people writing stuff to up the balance of happy in this world. I honestly think that.
Yeah. So can you tell me, like, what is the difference between the Casey Bateman and the Kate? Is it the setting mostly?
No, it's because my first three books for Random House were KC, and that was before I realized that having initials is such a pain in the ass. Search engines and having, do you have a full stop and then do you have a space, and then it's such a pain. I wish I had been Kate Bateman from the start. So when I swapped publishers 3 or 4 books ago, we said let's just go with Kate. So then I obviously had the KC stuff out that was self-published. So at some point I will change everybody over to Kate Bateman instead of KC, but at the moment I'm halfway through having half things as KC Bateman and a couple of indie books as KC. But they're the same me. There's no difference in tone or setting. It's
right.
I haven't changed the covers yet and I'm too lazy.
Isn't that the worst though, when like you make like that decision and then you're like, oh crap, now you got it. Because like people don't understand, like if you get a bunch of books back from a publisher or if you change a name, like how much work it is to fix it.
So Kate Bateman is my maiden name, and that's why I kept that, because I already had a sort of social media following from the TV and antique stuff in the UK. Mm-hmm. So it seems stupid to get a completely separate pen name. Obviously my real married name is not fully unsullied by this smut that is Kate Bateman. But I could have chosen a completely separate name, but I'm already two people. I'm already Kate and Casey and my married name. So three people really. So it just gets too confusing. To have all these.
Yeah, I did not enjoy having multiple pen names. I'm very happy to just be one person now. So I'm not. I think that that's like a how your brain works kind of thing. I mean, for some people, they really like having like that real demarcation between this is what I write is this, this is what I write is this, this is what I write is this. But for me, like my focus doesn't really like that too much. Like I want to just be one thing, doing one thing, and that seems to make me happy. But yeah, no, I just wasn't sure. I mean, I think it's an interesting thing, right? You don't really realize the ramifications of that until you start doing it and you realize, like you said, like, is it K period C period? Is it KC together? Is it Casey? Because Casey is the name. Like,
I know. It was such a, I don't know why somebody didn't bash me over the head.
Yes, why didn't someone stop you? You were with a publisher.
Well, because a lot of my, you know, you look at people like H.M. Ward or E.M. Forster. I mean, they have you know, for some reason, I just thought this was Dunbarton thing, right?
Right.
It was not the full Kate Bateman, but it was still Casey Bateman. So I don't know. It was, I think it's fine for contemporaries as well. Like almost, I think lots.
Yeah, that's true. In contemporary, it seems more common.
But for historicals, I can't think, there's not that many. So I don't know what I was thinking. Past me needed to have a message from future Kate to say, don't do it. It's so stupid.
Yeah. Well, when you get the time machine, you can tell her, but maybe, maybe next year. So I know that you have indie published and traditionally published. We've talked about that a little bit here earlier. And you've talked a little bit about your path to traditional publishing. But how are you liking kind of hybriding?
I really like it. It's really interesting. As you say, I like the fact that I get the exposure and into the main bookstores and things that I can get from the traditional publishing. But to be fair, yes, you get very little. You get a very small percentage of a large amount of sales versus potentially smaller sales as an indie when you're starting out. But you get like 70%, you know. So that's, it's just that I like being both because you've got those two things. And my hope is that if I ever get dropped by my traditional people, that by that point I will have built up enough of a following that will then follow me over and just, you know, they're readers who like my stuff. I don't think readers particularly care who, you know, who's selling the book, the print book. I mean, I would lose out on being in the physical stores, I guess, as an indie.
But so many of them are also still, they're buying online. Like, I mean, there are people that are just like, can you tell HarperCollins blah, blah, blah? And I'm like, I haven't written for HarperCollins in 10 years. And they don't realize it. So I'm like, well, I guess I'm doing the right thing because they don't recognize, like, it doesn't look like it's different to them. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, a book is a book, right? So it does, they're not looking at where it's being shipped from if you're buying it online. So, and that's what's been great, I guess, about the pandemic is that, yes, you want a book, you can have it a day later, you know, and it just arrives in your letterbox or whatever.
Or with the ebooks, like it's instantaneous.
Yeah.
I mean, I sell vastly far more ebooks than paperbacks. Paperbacks, you know, are kind of like, because I started out traditional.
Yeah.
You know, there are still readers that are readers of mine that want to read a paperback. But I mean, it's almost just a courtesy at this point and for the comparison. Yeah.
Like in terms of my indie sales, definitely it's nearly all ebooks. But I like a physical paperback. There's something about sniffing a real book, you know. I like that. Yeah, I mean, I suppose I like the best of both worlds. I don't like the fact as indie you have to do a lot in the sense of all the marketing and the publishing and all that kind of technical stuff that you really have to learn to do. And it's an endless learning curve. But at the same time, people do assume that if you're traditionally published, you don't have to do all that. And that's not actually true. I mean, I think I went into trad publishing thinking, oh, I'll have a marketing department and a publicist behind me and all of this stuff. And they do a lot. But there's still quite a lot that I still have to do off my own bat that nobody really tells you. You just kind of figure out as you go along, oh, I should probably be doing this, you know, myself. And so it's a big learning tip. And my indie author friends have been amazingly helpful in, you know, navigating me through all the things like me literally saying, how do I do this thing on KDP or what's Book Funnel? Or, you know, I can't, you know, how do I contact somebody at this thing? So it's an interesting set of skills that I've developed, but I'm really enjoying it so far.
Well, and I do think it's a good point. I mean, the indie crowd really is, it feels like it's very helpful. I think because there isn't the same kind of sense of false competition that's kind of set up, you know, where it's like, if you're within a publishing house, at least this is the way I felt about it. Like if I, you know, I'm not supposed to tell people if I'm getting X or Y, like that's what I was told. Don't tell somebody.
Yes.
And now it's, you know, I mean, as an indie, it's just like, I mean, when I said I'm going to go indie and I'm not really sure if I can do it, I don't know if I'm going to be okay. I mean, there were probably five people that reached out to me and were like, okay, let me just walk you through it, how you're going to be fine. You know? And it's like, oh, well, then I'm going to be fine. And I mean, that is something that I don't think it's unique to indie by any stretch of the imagination. I think lots of people help each other in trad publishing, but I think it's different. Like the level of it is so different.
Yeah. And certainly the nitty gritty and even things like talking about, you know, embarrassing things like sales figures and, you know, what you're getting paid and what you made and how much you've paid for advertising and stuff like that. I think indie is much more open about that. I mean, certainly my within my small group of close friends, we absolutely discuss everything like that, which is invaluable because you need to know if you're paying too much for advertising or you're not earning, you know, as much as you should be because you're not doing XYZ. So you're right. There isn't that competition. And I think the whole point is we all do well, right? If romance in general is doing well, we're all going to do well, right? We all write different kind of stories enough that we'll find our niche if we can find the readers. So they'll keep reading us as well as the other authors. It's not like they're going to stop reading us if they discover someone new. They'll still read us and the other person.
Right. And in fact, we can only ever help each other, because, I mean, the fact is, it's like if they find, you know, Kate Bateman Regency and they go, oh, I really like this, I want more Regency, who else writes Regency? And then they come along and they find me. Then, I mean, because you can only write so many books a year, and I can only write so many books a year, and somebody else can only write so many books a year. And so, but they're reading, you know, some of them are reading 300 or 400 books in a year. So we, like, there's not one of us that can produce 400 books in a year. I don't, that's just not possible. So that means that they have to be reading multiple people, which means that if they find something that is like you that they like, it's very possible they're going to find you. So we can only help each other by existing. We can't hurt each other.
And I, you know, that's, I love other, especially other authors saying who they have liked, you know, and if I find somebody that's like 3 or 4 books that I personally like, if they suggest 3 or 4, I'm pretty sure I'm going to like 2 out of those 3 as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all of my own reading is through recommendations and things that I have seen, if, you know, people who've liked similar things to me, and then it's sort of curated a kind of suggestion for me, I will go for it. And it's not necessarily historicals, it's just anything, right? I mean,
yeah.
There's certain ways of writing and styles that I seem to really like, and some that really I don't care for. So you very quickly learn to find who's an auto buy, who's a kind of maybe take a chance on, and who's like, no, I don't want to read them because I've read them before.
Right. Yeah. And we all have that, and there's like nothing wrong with that at all. And you know, I mean, that there's such a wide variety of what we like and don't like, and you know, that there's something out there for everybody. And like you said, I mean, I curate pretty much entirely on Twitter now. Like, that's how I find everything. And it's fine. It's work. Although I just feel like I'm not reading at all. Like, that's what I lost in the,
yeah,
in the fire of 2020. I'm just like, I'm not reading at all. It sucks, but you know,
well,
this is what it is.
Read. Usually I can't read, definitely no historicals when I'm writing my own book, which takes me 3 to 4 months to write my own book. So then after I finish a book, my reward is to have this, you know, 20 book to
your glam
that I just then I'm like, brain shuts off. I'm going to recharge my batteries by reading everything I can. And then I have to kind of stop and start my own book. But by that point, I'm kind of back to wanting to write again. But I can't just finish one book and start writing the next. And I'm really slow at writing. I mean, it takes me, I tell my publishers it takes me 6 months, but it actually takes me 4. But then life gets in the way for those other 2 months of children and dogs and everything else.
Right. You need the space for like something caught on fire, somebody vomited, like you need all that extra space.
And I don't want to be that stressed that I'm putting out a terrible book just because I'm on deadline. But I like the deadlines that traditional puts on me, because, you know, I can theoretically get sued and have to give my advance book if I don't finish it. And I do need that kick in the arse. Otherwise, I really wouldn't do it on time. So I like the fact that somebody's breathing down my neck at some point, even if it's just my editor saying, any chance of like a book next week?
You have that little clear of the throat and you're like, yeah, I'm on it. I'm sorry. I got it. I'm going to be there in a minute.
Time to burn the midnight oil for a couple of weeks to actually finish the damn book. But it happens. I need that. I know my system is clearly put it off until I really, you know, don't, until I can't put it off anymore. And then I happen to do it.
It's so funny how everybody's brain works so differently. I love it. I love that. Like, we all have a different process. We all get to the same end.
Well,
or similar end to a book, you know.
Have you found that? I mean, some books you get to the end and think, oh, that actually was that not that bad. That was pretty easy. And some are like pulling teeth. God knows.
I have golden books and struggle books, and then like other, you know, the kind of in between where it's like it's just the work or whatever. But yeah, I have golden books where it's just like that just slid out. That was weird. Don't get those too often. And then you have the struggle books where it's like every single word is like pain.
Exactly. And there's no logic. And some of those, it's not like saying the ones that come easy are the best or the worst, or the hard ones are the best or the worst. There's no logic. And the more books,
no, none,
you realize it's like, it's just, what the heck? Like, every book is different. I don't know.
But I think that's a good thing. I mean, I love that we talk about that more now, because I don't think it was, I mean, it's, at least when I started, I don't feel like I heard that. And so when I had those struggle books, I just thought I was weird. And now it's just like, oh no, this is just a struggle book.
Yeah, I think
that sucks. I wish it wasn't.
The traditional view of like the romantic poets all gazing out the window and, you know, it's being struck by inspiration is just rubbish, because inspiration has to strike at 9 a.m. every morning. You know,
right.
Not your job, and you don't get paid. So it's not, occasionally you'll get a gift scene, like it will just come to you, or you'll find this nugget of information that you're like, oh, that's really cool, and that's given me this whole idea for a scene or whatever. But sometimes it is just, you know, I need to think of the, you know, the technicalities of what's going in this scene. And it is hard work. It's not all fun and roses and champagne. That's
no, I hardly ever sit in a bathtub and eat bonbons while I do it, ever. It's very disappointing. I was sold a bill of goods.
I imagine that's how Barbara Cartland, you know, had a bright pink typewriter and a fluffy neck.
Yeah, but you know, she wasn't like, she would do that for photo shoots and then she'd just be, I imagine she was sitting there with her hair sticking up 16 different directions on a not pink typewriter, just going, why?
If yoga pants existed in the time of Barbara Cartland, you can guarantee she was wearing those in a fluffy bathrobe. Absolutely. Definitely.
Her peignoir. I just can't believe it, but our time is up. Do you want to tell everybody what your latest book or your next book is, whatever you want them to go look for?
Well, I had a book out about a month ago, which was the last in my Bow Street Bachelor series. That was called The Princess and the Rogue, which is a Russian princess who's sort of faked her own death, basically, and is hiding out in Regency London, as you do, you know.
Of course.
And the hero is a Bow Street runner, as all of the heroes are. But he's also an earl, so that's handy. So that was the next one. And the next, I've got a whole new series starting in the summer, in sort of August, September time, which is going to be the Ruthless Rivals series. And that's about two families on the England-Wales border in the Regency who, like Hatfields and the McCoys in the Regency, they hate each other for 500 years. And of course, we all know what happens when two people can't stand each other.
What could it be? that's great. I love enemies to lovers. So that sounds like catnip to me.
Favorites. So yeah, that's going to be a lot. The first one was a lot of fun to write. I've just finished that one up. So that will be called A Reckless Match, and it's on pre-order right now. So, oh, my last thing is, if this is going out in the next week or so, I have a freebie, which is... the first book of my Secrets and Spies series called To Steal a Heart is free everywhere right now till 4th of May.
No, 4th of May?
March.
For the March.
I'm in the wrong month. It's about 2 weeks from now. So 4th of March.
See, you guys are going to miss it because this won't actually air until the 10th of March. So
ignore
it. Just passed. Well, just ignore it. It'll happen again someday. Keep an eye out. Join her newsletter and that's probably how you find out this cool stuff.
Oh yeah, you can get a free Egypt set Regency novella called
There you go.
If you join my newsletter.
You missed Kate's freebie? Go join her newsletter. Now you get another one. What? Yeah.
Well, the newsletter's monthly-ish because I'm not that great at keeping the schedule. So if you get one, be happy. It's once a month. If you get more than once a month, bonus. If 2 months gone by and you've forgotten me, it's probably because I'm stuck in the writing cave and I just haven't got around to it.
Well, you know, we do the best we can.
Yeah, no.
Thanks so much for coming today.
Thank you for having me. It was lovely talking to you.
This has been Journeys of Romance. I'm Jess Michaels, your host. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next time.